Welcome to Wellness Unfiltered Pro Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Arland Hill, Director of Clinical Education for Biotics Research. Before I introduce our topic and professional panel today, I'd like to acknowledge our sponsor, Biotics Research. Family-owned and operated for nearly 50 years, Biotics Research continues to revolutionize the nutritional supplement industry by utilizing the best of science and nature to create high-quality nutritional supplements. With a continued focus on innovation and the use of unique and clinically proven delivery systems such as emulsified nutrients, vegetable culture tableting base, and plant matrix minerals, Biotics Research continues to be a pioneer in the professional nutritional supplement industry. Like supports like. Some may be familiar with this theory. It's a foundational belief in homeopathy. However, one does not have to practice homeopathy to apply this theory, as we will demonstrate in today's podcast. Our topic will be glandulars. The premise is that preparations of substances, when administered, have an affinity for the tissues like the ones being applied. For example, one might use a liver glandular to support liver function. Given the complexity of human physiology, it almost immediately appears that this is too simplistic of an approach to translate to real clinical outcomes. Of no surprise, many questions have arisen around this nutritional strategy. Do these actually work? Is there a history with glandular applications that we are unfamiliar with? Or are these simply placebos? Well, in today's conversation, we look to provide clarity on this topic. But before we delve into this conversation, allow me to introduce the professionals joining me today. First, Joe Bushes. Joe Bushes, a licensed dietitian nutritionist and CCN, has been using Biotics products clinically for over 40 years. He is also the host of a video magazine called The Tuesday Minute. Also with us is Daniel Benning. Daniel is an experienced practitioner and functional medicine consultant that has been with Biotics Research for over 25 years, covering Arizona and New Mexico. The glandular conversation has experienced a resurgence of interest in the last few years, due in part to the large interest in the carnivore diet. The acknowledgement in the value of animal products has become more mainstream than ever, leading to the question of how much nutritional value can we glean from these foods? The answer is not simply limited to macro and micronutrients. And as a result, when we explore glandulars, it becomes imperative to release limitations in the way we often think about nutrition. We are currently at the crossroads of traditional use and modern science when discussing glandulars. To give this story full context, we must revisit history and understand the beginnings of glandulars. To steer us down this road, I'm going to turn the conversation over to you now, Daniel.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Hill, for that introduction. And, you know, we talked about this earlier about being such a topic of passion for ourselves. And I appreciate you talking about the carnivore diet, and you look at the world of supplements out there getting into, you know, whole gland supplementation. But I, being as long as I've been with Biotics, I feel we have a really strong hold in this, in how we do this. But to kind of give context to the history for the people listening in here, you know, I look at this as foundational nutrition because this started so long ago, and not to bore you with details, but to give you like real concept of where this started, because I think we're guilty of today of getting into single pathways, single nutrients, really diving deep where this is feeding the system. So as I said, there's a long tradition of glandular use in medicine with the use of organ tissue dating back to the ancient Greeks. I mean, in Homer, there is some relation that Achilles ate bone marrow from lions to increase his strength. You know, like you said, like is treating like a little bit. In the Materia Medica of Aristotle and Pliny the Elder, there are allusions to extracts of organs used in their therapies. And if you look at this going forward, a Swiss physician by the name of Paracelsus taught the heart heals the heart and the kidney heals the kidney. Again, almost in the world of homeopathy, like treating like. Keep moving forward. It's still with us. Back in the 1850s, when Dr. Claude Bernard spoke of the essences of endocrine secretions, the medical community all of a sudden became interested in the materials produced within the endocrine glands, which could promote physiological change in humans. So following this, the procedure was to extract chemical constituents from the glands to produce products. And that's where then this all changed later in the 20th century with the development of synthetic hormones and drugs. Sadly, a lot of that glandular therapy knowledge and application kind of disappeared then. But in the 1930s, Dr. Nihon's injected glandular extracts of animal tissue into humans to induce rejuvenation, which had also been proposed by Dr. Kuttner in 1912. So the injection of the extract of vital organs be given to activate the regeneration of the system. So Nihon's work was the birth of cellular therapy, or I'm going to kind of put it out there, what we're now calling peptide therapy at some levels. Glandular therapy is essential oral cell therapy. I think it's important to know about this history, this foundation, because again, we get off into the weeds sometimes as practitioners and looking for that one pathway to fix that client, that patient. And I'm hoping with this podcast and the others we're going to put together on this topic, that we as clinicians, practitioners, doctors really step back and look at what we're going to talk about and the effectiveness of this therapy. 30 years in this industry, I know that you, Dr. Hill, and Joe Bushes, I know you've seen this as well in your areas. So that's a little bit of the history of glandular therapy.
Daniel, as you take us through back through that history, one of the things that comes to mind for me on this, we're not going to talk about thyroid glandular today. That'll be in a forthcoming conversation. But it's interesting because if you look at what has even been in the marketplace, when you look at something like Armour Thyroid, which is a glandular tissue, right? So glandulars are not a category that is absent from current conventional model. It does exist. And it also, another one that comes to mind for me are some of the prescription enzymatic formulations that are porcine derived. And so we do see these animal products being used in conventional applications. So again, it's not a completely foreign concept, but I think even from our standpoint on the non-conventional side, from a nutritional model, many times, for example, in functional medicine, if we're interested in the thyroid, we'll look at T4 and T3, and we're looking at ways to directly enhance those. And sometimes someone might ask, well, does your thyroid glandular contain T4 and T3? But I think when you ask that question, you've simplified the conversation so much as to ignore all the other necessities for the thyroid gland and for its just normal physiological operation. And to me, that brings forth the question of what exactly are glandulars? And so as I share this information with you, I want you to understand the perspective that I'm coming from in delivering this information to you. When I came to Biotics, I was the most skeptical individual of glandulars. Like that just did not resonate with me. And now here we are several years down the road, and it is literally one of my favorite categories. And I often heard that there's not evidence to support glandulars. Well, I'm getting ready to share some things with you that are going to dispute that. So again, back to the core question here, what exactly are glandulars? Well, let's look at what the constituents of a glandular, and more specifically a cellular tissue, should actually be comprised of. And so just bear with me. I'm going to go through a list here with you, but there's two key areas in this list that I'm going to pull out and dive deeper in. So if you look at what makes these up, you have structural proteins as well as structural non-proteins. So again, think about cellular composition, phospholipids, glycosaminoglycans, glycolipids. These are all in the basic cell structures. And many times individual tissues, for example, various organs, will have slight nuances that are different from other organ tissues. In addition, you can have functional proteins and peptides in here. Just one example, might be, for example, a neuropeptide. You know, if we got into talking about brain glandular tissue, you would look at the various neurotrophic factors that would be in that specific tissue. And again, that's just one example, but those are something that are found in all tissues. They're unique to all organ systems. You have various enzymes that are unique to the individual glands. You have, of course, amino acids. There's hormones in here. Now, let me be very clear when I say hormones, exactly what I'm referencing on this. I'm not talking about your steroid hormones. I'm not talking about what we typically think about with the major peptide hormones. I'm talking about hormones like, for the thymus gland, the thymic hormones. These are signaling molecules, but they are unique. They're inherent in those tissues, and they allow those tissues to be able to fully express their natural physiology, to operate and to function at a very high level that if those hormones didn't exist, if they weren't in sufficient quantities, then we don't get the intracellular communication that we're looking for. Growth factors. Now, this is one that I'm going to dive deep with you on in just a moment here, but we have growth factors, we have cofactors, we have nutrients that are unique to that tissue, we have DNA, RNA, and we have microRNA, which is the next area that I'm going to dive deep into with you. But when you even just look at something like microRNA, which has the ability to influence up to 100 genes with each microRNA strand. So when you ask, what are glandulars? That list that I just gave you answers the question of what glandulars are comprised of. And the way that we should think about these is on a broad scale. How many mechanisms, how much structural impact can we have on the tissues that we're trying to target with that list that I just shared with you? Now, I told you that I wanted to pull two of these out specifically, and the first are going to be growth factors. Now, why are growth factors important? Well, growth factors at their core are generally going to be growth stimulating compounds. They're going to be peptides, polypeptides most of the time. And when you look at tissues that are going to be richest in growth factors, it's going to be neonatal tissues. Now, we'll have more conversation around that coming up, but this is the anabolic nature that we're trying to tap into. And you can just look at us as humans and really any species. We start out as very small creatures, and then as we grow, as that anabolic gas pedal, if you will, has been mashed and we're accelerating, we see in our younger years are when we have our fastest growth phases. That slows and it tapers off as we hit adulthood, and that's across all species. And so it's really that early neonatal anabolic activity that we want to tap into that is driven at least in part by these growth factors. Now, we have fibroblastic growth factors, we have epidermal growth factors, we have insulin-like growth factor, which many have heard of, but these are not just related, for example, with the insulin-like growth factors, that's not just related to the liver and growth hormone and to glycemic components. These molecules are found in the platelets, they're found in the kidneys, the intestines, the salivary glands. And if you just think, how often do you do GI work with someone? Well, pretty much every day, maybe the majority of your patients, I would venture, most of us are doing some type of GI support. And this is where these growth factors can start to come into play. You also look at things like these fibroblastic growth factors, which are fairly ubiquitous throughout the body as well. And then you'll also see, I mentioned some of the neurotropic growth factors, things like brain-derived neurotrophic factor, synuclein, just as another example on that. These are all things that are inherent in the tissues that uniquely comprise these components. So, for example, you would find those in the brain tissue. Now, the one area that I want to touch on a bit more before I turn this over to Joe is I mentioned to you that there are also microRNAs. Now, I'm just going to venture a guess on this that many of you may not have heard of microRNAs. In fact, before I started doing my own research and digging into glandulars and how they actually function and work, I didn't have an understanding of what microRNAs were. I didn't even know they existed, to be quite frank. But I'll give you a couple ideas exactly how microRNAs come into play. So these are short strands of RNA. And some of the things that have been identified in the research with these is that they can literally be used as diagnostic markers. So to give you an idea of how significant they are, when it comes to monitoring disease or monitoring just general health or looking at potential progression towards a disease state, microRNAs are something that can be looked at. They've been looked at as interventions in severe chronic diseases. And even when we talk about things like nutrigenomics and looking at taking in certain foods with bioactive compounds, part of what they're doing are modulating the microRNA. And so when you don't have adequate availability of the microRNA, that's where you see impairments in neurological function and cognition. You can see infectious diseases become more problematic, decreases in overall immune function. So my point on this is that even though we look at glandulars and we think about glandulars with this historic mindset, the truth on these is that based on what we're finding with glandulars and what we can now acknowledge are part of the glandular composition, this is truly next-gen medicine. And just to really put an exclamation point on what I'm sharing with you here, in 2024, so very recently, the Nobel Prize was awarded to two researchers for their work on microRNA. So this is not just something that is sort of in the shadows of science in the scientific community. This is very forward-facing right now, and this is something that we absolutely want to understand. But here's where I want to really lead you to, and this is where I want Joe to pick up the conversation, is Daniel's giving you the history. I've told you what they're made up of, but what makes the Biotics Research Glandular a completely different option compared to the others that you see in the marketplace? And Joe, I think your history is so well poised to be able to help us answer this question.
Well, thanks, Dr. Hill. And, you know, since the early 80s, Biotics has been at the forefront of glandular production. They started out producing glands. It was kind of an offshoot of some original research that were performed by their CDC-licensed genetics toxicology laboratory. Biotics developed the first mobile laboratory to respond to environmental contamination. And this mobile laboratory was able to provide rapid assessment of possible chromosomal damage. And listeners may know that Biotics was a major player in detecting the toxic waste contamination in Love Canal back in 1980, and reporting the chromosomal damage at Love Canal sparked a massive toxic waste removal program across the country. But to do their research, they needed fetal calf serum. And when it became limited, because other big tech companies were jumping in, they looked at developing their own source, and they found newborn calves as an alternative source. So serum isolated from these animals, then tested at the National Institutes of Health, they found that newborn calves became the source of high-quality glandular tissue. So from the beginning, the organ and tissue, glandular tissues from Biotics Research are harvested from animals that are BSA-free countries. They're collected and harvested under USDA inspection. Most of the Biotics glandular products incorporate tissues from newborns, often called neonatals, from 1 to 3 days old. They're harvested at specific facilities for Biotics to ensure quality. And further research showed that tissues from newborn animals possess higher anabolic activity. And that's the key word, is anabolic activity. As you mentioned earlier, growth activity. And they have minimal exposure to environmental stressors. Older animals show atrophy, fatty infiltration, tissue degeneration, and accumulation of oxidative waste products, often called lipofusion. But it's pretty dramatic to see the slides of tissues of newborn animals versus older animals. And neonatal glands are a completely different product from most commercially available glandular products. And just to give you an idea, most commercially available glandular products, the raw materials are collected from different cattle carcasses of various ages, obtained from numerous slaughterhouses. These tissues are then pooled, processed into powder preparations and sold to manufacturers. And some of these processing things involve harsh chemicals like hexane to get to remove the fat, whereas neonatal animals can use a bean extract that they use because there's not as much fat or as much toxic material. So these, again, these tissues are pooled or collected into powder preparations, sold to manufacturers, and then manufacturers encapsulate them and sell them in powders or tablets or tablets. But clinicians and consumers have no knowledge or understanding of their sources, the age of the animals used, or the degree of environmental toxins or the environmental exposure. These test glands are never tested for pesticides, herbicides, or metal contamination. So it's not apples and oranges. It's apples and watermelons with neonatal glands versus adult glands.
Joe, that's such a good dive into what the difference is. And before we started recording here, Daniel and I were talking about this, and I'm sure over the years you've seen this as well, had the opportunity to actually be standing in our production facility when the glandulars come in or when the technicians are actually handling the glandulars in the specific room that we have in our facility set aside to handle these. And they are literally, like you said, going through these and looking over them by hand, raw tissue as it's coming in. But you can also see when you look at that tissue, the vibrancy of the color, just acknowledging that these are younger animals, it's healthy tissue. It is truly exemplifying exactly what you just said. So it's quite impressive to be able to observe that firsthand. I want to make sure that in this conversation, we've talked a lot about background here, but I want to make sure that we leave the listeners with some actual clinical application here too. And so I want us to move now, if we can, guys, into talking about a couple of products, with the acknowledgement that this certainly will not be the only conversation that we have around glandulars, and we will get through all of the glandular options in the biotics research line. But today we're going to look at some of the non-endocrine glandulars. And Joe, I want to come back to you because one of the glandulars that we offer, cytosine thigh, is for thymic tissue. And the thymus is a very interesting tissue in that in most individuals, it is atrophied. We don't tend to talk about it a lot, but when you think about all the different immunological challenges that we are faced with in society, certainly having an active functional thymus gland is a necessity. And this is where cytosine thigh comes in. So, Joe, I want to turn this back to you to speak about that.
Okay. Well, first of all, the oral use of thymus tissue is, there's over 80 references published on the use of thymus preparations and extracts and treatment. But most of the, what's interesting is of the thymic tissue, most of the things that have been observed are really have to do with cellular immunity. So it's things like helper cells, suppressor cells, cytotoxic cells, natural killer cells, and macrophages are what's stimulated. Biotics product is called Thytozyme THY, THY for thymus. And cytosine thymus contains 125 milligrams of neonatal thymus, also contains 20 micrograms of the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase and 20 micrograms of catalase. And both of those are very important to prolong shelf life of the product and to protect the integrity of the product. It was assayed by independent laboratories and found out that it increased T-cell rosette by 42%, which was literally two times greater than what we see that other competitors' adult thymus glandulars produce. So here we come back to this adult versus neonatal difference. But the whole topic of adult versus newborn glands is so important, and most clinicians don't even think about it. Biotics went on to publish a histological examination of adult versus newborn tissue in 1985, and you can see those changes. And talk to your sales rep or biotics, and you can get a copy of that article because it's so powerful to see the structural integrity and the fatty tissue infiltration and the glandular degeneration that takes place with these older animals. And newborn animals are active. They produce a variety of T-cell lymphocytes. They produce high amounts of thymic factors and hormones, as you mentioned. And I like that how you turn that hormones are really signaling compounds. They're the most powerful signaling things that we have to turn on the function of the cells. And so we always think of hormones, like you said, thymus or thyroid or an insulin being hormone, but they really do provide these signaling compounds. Newborn tissues contain higher amounts of DNA as younger animals, and they're just primed for growth. What was another concept, as long as we're talking about animals, there was a study that showed that comparing bovine to porcine thymic extracts, and they found that the bovine thymic induced the highest amounts of interleukin-2, interferon, and tumor necrosis factor alpha. So we're talking about glands. Many times the porcine is more effective, but for thymus in particular, it's the bovine that gives you the most bang for your dollar. So one example of this, and kind of going off on talking about clinical stuff, was Naomi Judd was a famous country singer, author, who stopped singing due to hepatitis B. She met a medical doctor by the name of Carson Bursinger. He was a medical doctor, former president of the Georgia Medical Association. And he was using calf thymus to recover from his own hepatitis B. And he'd been fighting it for 7 years. And he was able to completely clear the virus from his DNA. And that was confirmed by Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California, Harvard Medical, and Wayne State University. Wayne State University later reported that 86% of the patients with hepatitis B were treated with calf thymus, were cleared, the virus was cleared from their DNA. And so like Dr. Bernstinger, Naomi Judd was able to clear the virus from her DNA and return to singing career. And by the way, Dr. Bursinger always used a good multiple with his patients. You mentioned thymulin earlier. Thymulin, one of the things that we need for thymulin to be its most active component is zinc. And so we always want to use multiples to support the other factors of that. But here's another thing. Most of physicians are aware that we have a two-part immune system, the innate or the non-specific adaptive. The non-specific adaptive is highly specific, as you know. And I like to think of the innate as kind of the hand-to-hand combat, because natural killer cells and phagocytes fight harmful substances and germs that enter the body. It doesn't matter if it's the oral cavity, the skin, digestive tract, but they fight bacterial and viral invaders. And part of the innate immune system is to call or signal the adaptive system into action. The adaptive system, as we know, makes antibodies and uses them specifically to fight infections. But when you look at the cytokines that we mentioned earlier that come with calf tissue thymus, we realize that calf tissue thymus supports the innate immune system. Now, we've just gone through this terrible experience with mRNA vaccines. And one of the things that we found is that they create or overstimulate the adaptive or the acquired immune system. So an immunologist shared with me years and years ago that as the adaptive immunity goes up, the innate immunity system goes down. So reason I mention that is if clinicians are looking for ways to support the innate immune system, consider cytozyme thymus and dosages from 2 to 4 tablets 4 times a day. And again, as a clinical tip, when we see the percentage of lymphocytes greater or equal to neutrophils on a CBC, think about chronic underlying viral infections. And we're not saying that cytozyme thymus cures viral infections. Matter of fact, the doctor I mentioned earlier wasn't using necessarily biotics products. However, these calf tissue products have a profound effect upon our immune system, and we don't want to forget that.
Joe, one of the things that comes to mind for me when you start speaking on cytozyme thigh that I want to underscore for everyone is that if you're skeptical when it comes to glandulars, one of the best tissues that you can start to research is thymic tissue. There's quite a bit of evidence when it comes to conventional applications. And I think this will start to give you a new perspective on exactly how glandulars can serve a role in human physiology. Joe, I'm going to transition off of cytozyme thigh. I'm going to move on to cytozyme H. And the naming convention within biotics is that generally we call the cytozyme products glandulars. You'll see there's a few exceptions to that, but then there's going to be a letter or two letters that are going to oftentimes reference the tissue that we're trying to target here. So in the case of cytozyme H, we're going to be talking about the heart tissue. Now, when you look at bovine heart tissue, some of the thoughts on this maybe what kind of applications would this come into play with? Well, of course, what probably comes to mind right off the top of the list are going to be cardiovascular applications. So if you think in terms of someone having a myocardial infarction and having damaged necrotic tissue there that we need to support and try to have an anabolic effect and optimize that tissue, make sure that we have optimal availability of things like coenzyme Q10, specific amino acids that are unique to the cardiac tissue. Certainly, cytosine H is going to be one of the forerunners to think about in that scenario. But additionally, where you might come into play are going to be things as simple as fatigue and weakness. Right along with that, a lot of times we can see low blood pressure being a consideration for individuals as well. So if you think about organ systems and their associations with each other, you know, initially you may think fatigue, weakness, low blood pressure. You may be thinking adrenals, and we'll talk in future conversations about the adrenal glandulars, but cytosine H, the heart tissue, is also a consideration in these scenarios as well. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, not necessarily talking about under the umbrella of dysfunction, but thinking more in regards to overall health optimization, think in regards to athletic performance, where you're trying to optimize cardiac output, where you're trying to support ATP production. That is a more optimization application of cytosine H that could be employed as well. And I want to go back real quickly to the microRNA conversation, because there was a study, one of the studies that really opened my eyes around this is back from 2013. And the name of this study is MicroRNAs in Cardiovascular Disease from Pathogenesis to Prevention and Treatment. But what this study illustrates is that the presence of these microRNAs in this cardiac specific tissue, they go on to talk about things being addressed such as hypertension, hyperlipidemia, even looking at atherosclerosis. And what I find very unique about this study is that this study actually looked at mechanistically how these microRNAs are playing a role, which again, of course, translates back to the glandular tissue. So definitely if you're thinking in regards to risk reduction, if you're thinking in regards to trying to support someone maybe that has unfortunately already had some type of cardiovascular accident, this may be the channel that you want to look into. Now, I will transition from cytosine H over to cytosine B, and cytosine B here, B being brain. And when you look at this, this is one of the exceptions to our conventional bovine sourcing. So this is actually an ovine sourcing. So that's going to be sheep. And in this scenario, these are going to be animals that when you look at sheep, and especially when you talk about brain tissue, one of the things that many people have an immediate concern around is there going to be risk for scrappy? I mean, scrappy is essentially the sheep equivalent to mad cow disease. And the answer to that is no. These are actually coming from sources where scrappy has not been seen since the 1950s, and it was only identified in single animal at that time. So this is not a risk. It's not something that we have to be concerned about. It has been eradicated from these sources by all standards. And when you look at what is actually taking place when you give cytosine B, well, cytosine B, if you go back and you start thinking about some of those neurotropic factors. Now, again, we can talk about signaling molecules like the growth factors, brain-derived neurotrophic factor probably being one of the most obvious that many of are familiar with. And of course, we would see that in a neonatal and a younger animal. You would see that that would be at higher levels. But also when you think about trying to optimize things like synaptic plasticity, when you're trying to optimize the phospholipid concentrations in the brain, that's where a product like cytosine B is going to come into play. And these are going to be able to offer, in addition to the glandular tissue, one of the consistent things that you'll see in all of these glandulars is that there's also going to be the catalase and the superoxide dismutase that Joe had mentioned, because those are the tabulating base. And so you get that added benefit of supporting that antioxidative effect along with the glandular tissue. So what I want to do now, if we can, is Daniel, I want to come to you on this, and I want to talk about Cytozyme LV and let you pick up the conversation with this one.
Hey, thanks, guys. You know, I sit here and I'm listening to all this foundational information to really build what is in these amazing nutrients. And again, I want to go back to our sourcing a little bit, because as a clinician, as a practitioner, I think we need to be, it's a buyer beware industry a little bit. And as Joe was talking about the sources and how we source these, so Cytozyme LV is neonatal liver from bovine. And like Joe, you mentioned, when you look at the slides of neonatal tissue versus adult tissue, it's so clear on how clean and how vibrant that material is. Dr. Hill, as you mentioned when we were talking earlier, you know, being abiotic and seeing that material hand processed, instead of an analogy, just for a visual out there to you listening, is a, you know, 55-gallon drum of powder coming in that you don't know the source of the material. So I really want people to think in that area, because as we all know, you know, this takes me back to my childhood. Maybe my mother knew way more than I did, liver and onion dinner, you know. You know, but back then, when I was much, much younger, the sourcing of liver tissue was really much cleaner. But liver is loaded, as you know, with supernutrients, vitamin A, B12, the minerals, the amino acids. We've talked about what these glands carry. But I want to give you some therapeutic action here, some protocols too, which we've already done in the other glands. Is, you know, think of, I'll give the example. I live in Phoenix and I'm a road rep. I'm sucking muffler fumes all day long. Our toxic exposure from environmental factors, from our food factors, from what's on our food. And we always talk about detoxification and all these pathways of detoxification, where here's a perfect product to support that liver that is going through basically on a daily basis, a real onslaught of need of, you know, metabolizing our hormones, metabolizing whatever we've taken in. And that's where liver tissue can come in so helpfully. Last week, I was working with a practitioner, a nurse practitioner in New Mexico, and she has a gentleman that has liver disease from, you know, not the greatest lifestyle choices. This is a perfect application for Cytozyme LV. You know, you look at the incidences of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Not to say, like you said, Joe, that we treat or cure any of this, I want to be very clear, but using supportive nutrients in these pathways, these foundational components, we know, many of our clinicians know that, you know, what is the cause of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, why people are getting there with the poor diet and the high amount of sugars in our diet. But these are absolute applications of liver tissue. Think anytime you're doing detox. Think anytime somebody has elevated liver enzymes, the stress on the liver is massive. And this is where a nutrient comes in. You know, it said early reports indicate that liver extracts infused into animals induced liver growth. Let me say that again. Sometimes we need to hear it a couple of times and really put it in the processes. Liver extracts infused into animals induced liver growth. And that regenerating liver produces a factor that stimulates growth in regenerating liver lobes, which was later identified as hepatocyte growth factor. We've talked about these growth factors. That's out of a study from 1979 out of the Lancet that was published in. So as I said, liver is such a rich source of essential nutrients, including iron, and I said the A, the B, the 12, B12. Liver is also a source of factors that increase endurance in experimental animals. And that was out of the American Journal of Natural Medicine. So the information's out there. Like you were saying, Dr. Hill, if you dove deep enough, the information is out there. You know, this isn't like hearsay. And, you know, many, many moons ago when I worked for an osteopath, he used a lot of glandular therapy. I want to segue for a second, if you don't mind, to add on to Joe's amazing story on thymus. One of my favorites is what we're talking about today is non-hormone secreting glands, okay? So my son, who is now 17, time flies, but that was his product when he was an infant, was Cytozyme thymus for his immune system. because it's a non-hormone secreting gland, I feel it's very safe to use in younger population to boost their immunity, you know, because he was at daycare with the snot-nosed, runny kid, you know, eyes, droopy eyes, snotty-nosed kids from infections. I wanted to boost his system as best as I could. Thymus was a big factor in that. Like you said, Joe, for the other populations of immunity, one of my favorites, not to segue too far, but I wanted to bring in that process. These are non-hormone secreting glands, so you're not shifting the hormonal process like people would think we would, like we'll talk about adrenal in a further talk. But I wanted people to be aware that that's a great application. So tying it back to liver, is that was my topic, obviously, but the bottom line is that the constituents of liver support liver function. So as a clinician listening out there, a doctor listening out there, anytime you see what we've talked about, you know, liver kind of viruses, like you talked about with thymus, Joe, you know, these EBVs, these CMVs and things of that nature, we need to support the liver. That is your biggest filter system. And great that we do the very specific pathways of phase one, phase two detoxification, but giving the foundational nutrition support, I think, is really important.
Daniel, I appreciate that. And you mentioned that Lancet study, certainly not an obscure journal when you're talking about the Lancet. That's a pretty mainstream journal that we're looking at there. I want to move over now into cytosine parotid TS. You know, when you look at the parotid gland, salivary glands, what you're thinking about, and you may kind of immediately ask the question, why do we need to support the salivary glands? Well, we want to mechanistically think through this. And when you look at the production of saliva, right off the bat, we can appreciate that that's going to initiate digestion. And certainly if we don't optimize the initiation of digestion in the mouth, that's ultimately going to affect all of the further functions in the gastrointestinal tract through the digestive process further downstream. So that one's really at the top of the list. Now, there's also quite a bit of anecdotal input when it comes to parotid glandular tissue that is related to toxins and supporting of the immune system. And I say anecdotal, and I'm going to also give you some scientific applications here, or some scientific validity as well. But when it comes to the anecdotal input, when you think about the management of the toxins, many times individuals will apply, if someone has a really high toxic burden, they don't handle traditional detoxification approaches very well, cytosine parotid TS can be a very easy introduction into the detoxification process that is not going to overwhelm the system, probably in part simply because it's also providing a supportive channel versus just trying to clear the toxin out of the body immediately. So it's having a very high level effect. But I said that there's also scientific validity as well, and that comes from one of the bioactive components that is found in the parotid glands, and this is a protein called peritin. And peritin has been directly shown to be able to support the immune response. We've talked about cytosine thiol, obviously how important that is, but now we see another glandular tissue that's having an impact on the immune system, even at the point of what is taking place with the salivary glands and starting in the mouth. So this is one that you probably won't use this one a lot, but this is certainly one of those that when you run into those patients that you need some, you've got to think outside of the box. How am I going to support this patient? They have a very fragile constitution, and I need to have gentle interventions, but effective interventions. This is where you're going to find cytosine parotid TS to be very applicable at. Joe, I'm going to hand the conversation back to you. We're going to talk about one more glandular tissue here, which is cytosine SP. And so take that one for us, if you will.
Okay. You know, before I, let me just go back to Daniel's discussion of the liver. He and I are both CCNs, and one of the people in the CCN group actually did a study. And what he did was he did a basic blood test looking at liver enzymes, thyroid function, lung function, etc. And just giving the glandular tissue was able to move those enzyme levels to back down into normal. And so even though we're not specifically saying it's going to change blood levels, you know, we've seen it in several papers. But biotics SP stands for spleen, cytidine spleen. It's, again, a neonatal tissue, 200 milligrams, which is a pretty healthy dose, as well as the 20 micrograms of superoxide dismutase and catalase. The spleen really represents the largest mass of lymphatic tissue, which really says a lot. The lymphatic system is your superhighway. So there's a lot going on in the spleen. It destroys worn out blood cells and platelets, as well as bacteria. It produces something called tough skin and spleenophin, both of which enhance the immune system. For example, Tufsin stimulates macrophages and other defensive cells to ward off infections. Tufsin deficiency is linked to bacterial infections in AIDS patients. Neonatal spleen is active in producing and programming lymphocytes, much less for adults, but specifically for kids, for newborns, I'm sorry. The spleen from newborn calves reveals large lymphoid follicles with a greater concentration as opposed to adult animals. Again, we come back to this young animal versus old animals. We see spleen function decreasing or declining with age. And we also see that aging increases or reduces the amount of superoxide dismutase in spleens. So in other words, oxidative damage to the spleen is associated with aging, and age loss of immune function has been correlated with the accumulation of oxidative damage in spleen lymphocytes. So a couple of clinical notes, extracts have stimulated immune cells during recovery from somebody who's been exposed to radiation. So if you've got a patient that's been exposed to radiation, you might want to, and they've got low white blood cells, consider spleen therapy. Also, one of the things that I learned is that spleen actually has the highest amount of bioavailable iron. So just by its nature, it's got some iron. So if you see people with low iron and you can't get it up, you might want to consider splenic using cytosine spleen. I've used that with several patients that have been resistive, can't get their ferritin levels up. On a little bit of a different topic, and just kind of wind this out, Dr. Chapman was an osteopath in the early 1980s, and basically he spent his whole life studying different reflex points and with people in the hospital. So he'd find somebody in the hospital that had a liver problem, and he found that when he would touch a certain point on the body, the neurolymphatic point, he called them neurolymphatic points, that the neurolymphatic point for the liver would be tender, and that by rubbing that out, that really made a big difference in their recovery. And Dr. George Goodhart followed up with that work. And you can see Dr. Chapman's work in a book called An Endocrine Interpretation of Chapman's Reflexes. And so Dr. Chapman found that on the he had a picture of all the different glands. But when he found that on the left side, about the seventh intercostal space underneath the arm, if that area is tender, think spleen. If you want to go on the right side about 4 inches down and it's tender, you might want to think thymus. So a lot of people might think, well, how do I know that there's a problem? One might even consider spleen. Well, if you've got an immune system that's not responding, that would be something that you might want to consider. But, you know, most of the doctors that we're talking to have the ability to palpate that seventh intercostal space underneath the arms about 5 inches down. If that's sore or tender, that might be an indication to consider splenic therapy.
Thanks for that input, Joe, on cytosine SP. Definitely some applications. The one around anemia certainly stands out to me on this. And guys, I can just tell from all of our input on this topic today that there's so much more we want to share and say about this. And as we draw to a conclusion on today's podcast, I want our audience to know that this conversation is only part one of a multi-part series. We're definitely going to dive deeper into this. So from their earliest use, there's always been an understanding that glandulars were unique, and the clinical insights shared today only serve to validate a storied past and hopefully give you, the practitioner, a new tool in your clinical tool belt. But remember, there will be more information on this topic in upcoming podcasts, so make sure you join us for those conversations. If you're looking for additional information on any of the products or resources mentioned in today's show, please reach out to your local representative or the home office. In closing, I want to thank Joe and Daniel for their willingness to share their time and experience to help us all become more versed in the appropriate application of biotics research products. We all appreciate you being a part of today's podcast and hope you will join us again for another episode of the Wellness Unfiltered Pro podcast.